Stryker here. He's from Montgomery County, has one of the most interesting legislative districts right outside the nation's capital. Wheaton, Kensington, Chevy Chase, what other amazing neighborhoods am I
Silver
leaving
Spring
out there,
in there as well? Yep, exactly.
Silver Spring, wow. So you and Senator Smith, sort of Chairman Smith, lit up both judicial proceedings portfolio as well as the Silver Spring constituent service experience?
That's exactly right. So I have an incredibly diverse district. I grew up over in Wheaton and love representing that part of the county. Now I live here in Kensington, also represent Chevy Chase. On my eastern edge is my chairman's district. So he has downtown Silver Spring and the eastern neighborhoods of Silver Spring. So it's a lot of fun working with Will Smith. He's a great chairman and just a wonderful human being to be neighbors with here in Montgomery County.
I saw a pretty amazing photo of your son dropping on Twitter.
And that's right.
He looked like he was having some fun. Tell me about your dad situation, because I think a lot of us, whether you're in the district or in Annapolis or even us folks all over the internets, we just wonder how somebody at your level, you know, manages to also spend so much time with family and to focus on a legal practice. It just seems like a heck of a balance.
Well, no question about it. So, you know, in my role as a legislator, I always remind myself that before I am a legislator, before I'm a senator, I'm a father and a husband first. So thanks for mentioning that photo. It's of my son, Harry, who's named for my grandfather. And Harry just went and got his first vaccine shot. So as you know, Damien, 5 to 11-year-olds are now eligible. He's 8, so he's smack dab in the middle of that. And he was incredibly excited. This is a kid who doesn't like needles, but he knew that with this vaccine came a certain sense of safety. And his older siblings, I have twins that are 12, are already fully vaccinated. And he was so excited to be like his older siblings. He was so excited to be vaccinated. And he knew that it also makes his life easier, that he can go places now that he couldn't go before. So any of your listeners, if you have kids that are 5 to 11, the appointments are open. They are available. I certainly encourage you to do it. And I was proud to go with him in that moment.
Yeah, I would just encourage you to, like, as long as the my kids can't bear it sometimes, but to capture those moments as a senator, as a father. You know, it's a very different world and opportunity, candidly, than our friend, say, Melanie Miller grew up with her dad, the Senate president. You know, they didn't have all the social media around, but you could only imagine what that would be like. And so to see your state senator also being a dad and the fun of family and success of family and health of family intersecting with social media, I think gives everybody a more human sense of your public service. And I'd just like to thank you for that, because I don't think people realize, I don't think senators realize how much of your life you sacrifice in the service of this very special constituency that you have come from and represent. So I know it sounds sort of like platitudes, but just as a dad, I think people need to see what's going on there, and just can't thank you enough.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. You know, I've always been a private person, never wanted to be the kind of person who allowed myself to use my kids as a prop in my political campaigns. But what I found is, you know, it's a struggle to be a dad. It's a struggle to balance work and parenthood and being a husband. And the more public I am with that balance and that struggle, the more people realize, oh, listen, my legislator is going through the same thing that I'm going through. And I use my lessons as a dad and as a husband to advance policy that benefits people who are in similar circumstances. And so that's why I've been more public than I think my instinct would be, because everyone's going through something. And when they realize that their legislator may be going through that exact same thing, it makes them more trustful of government, which is a really good thing.
That's a great point. And it's direct to the people. It's closer to the people. You're right there. There's no intermediary. One example of that that I recall from my career is being like a 28-year-old staff person for the Baltimore County Executive. Wonderful man, a former judge, Jim Smith. And the county executive always talk about sidewalks, curbs, and gutters. Sidewalks, curbs, and gutters. Never curbs, sidewalks, and gutters. And I never really got that until I was a, 33-year-old dad who noted that, some developer of one community got away with not having to put in a sidewalk and the rest of the community did. And, now it's starting to click. And there was a really dramatic example of that in your district where you've been talking about public safety in a pedestrian sense. Folks need to think about where Wheaton is. It's one of the most dense commercial connected areas in the DC community. And your whole district has that kind of vibe. And most recently in your district, you had a big sort of a pedestrian experience, I think, that must have only undergirded your fears as a father and your commitment as a public servant.
That's right. Yeah. Unfortunately, a 4-year-old girl was killed along Georgia Avenue in the area right between Wheaton and Silver Spring that I represent. And certainly my thoughts go out to her family. It's a terrible tragedy, and we're keeping them in our prayers. Things like this are happening all too frequently in Montgomery County, and it's time to take action. And there's no silver bullet for this. There's no easy way out here. It takes a whole of government approach. So we need the county council and the county executive and our state legislators and state highway administration, Montgomery County Department of Transportation, to all get together and think of the right solutions along these roads. But I am putting in legislation that I think will be helpful in that regard. We have an incredible police department that does these accident reports where they do crash reconstruction, and they say exactly what happened and how. They can look at tire marks and say, how fast was that car going? These are incredible professionals, well-trained professionals who put together a really thorough report. But what the police crash report does not include is recommendations for changes. And it's in part because police are not best positioned to make those recommendations. Traffic engineers are. And so our legislation will require State Highway or Montgomery County Department of Transportation, when there is a death, to append that police report with recommendations as to how to prevent something like this from happening in the future. And I think that'll go a long way in preventing future deaths, including pedestrian deaths, bicyclist deaths, deaths of people in cars, passengers and drivers alike. So we can take some steps. It's very necessary in Montgomery County, and I think we're going in the right direction.
You think you have more power to the conversation as a community leader, convener, dad in a crisis like that? Or do you feel like and how you can sort of impact the culture by getting the whole community aligned as they focus on solving those problems? Or do you think the legislative outcome is the most impactful piece of that? Sometimes sure. I wonder.
No, I think that's a good question. I am a problem solver by nature, and that's how I approach legislation. That's how I approach my relationship to Annapolis. But before I'm a problem solver, like we've been talking about, I'm a dad, and I try to lead with empathy. So when I heard about the 4-year-old girl who died on Georgia Avenue, my first instinct wasn't about solving this problem. It was empathy for the family. And then you try to harness that empathy and use it for good. And then you pivot to the problem solving. And so I think it's easy for those of us who have been doing this for a while to get cold to some of the things we see in our community and look at problems like an engineer. But ultimately, we have to lead with our values and lead with empathy. And that's what I always try to do each and every time.
Zachary, our producer here, is grateful that we don't pop up the Maryland manual every time I mention it, but it is such a useful resource to do a little digging on our guests. And one thing that struck me is that you look at what you would think would be sort of an unimportant part of the Maryland manual. Way down at the bottom, it talks about some early memberships in advisory boards, legislative, and et cetera. And I just want to read them to people because the years to me are striking. So member, Criminal Justice Information Advisory Board, 2007 was when that started. Task Force on Prisoner Reentry, 2010. State Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Board, 2013. So, you know, 2010 is 11 years ago. I mean, you're a young man, with all due respect, Senator. 2010, you're working on a task force for prisoner reentry. 2007, you know, when we had members of the General Assembly, you know, graduating college, you're on the Criminal Justice Information Advisory Board. You know, you are way ahead of the game on some of these issues that are, you know, demanding, you know, conversation and in the zeitgeist of the culture right now. Just love your reaction on seeing those issues evolve as somebody who's been at the center of them for so long.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. There's no question criminal justice reform has been at the heart of my career, and making sure we have a criminal justice system that is fair and transparent and that treats everyone equally is the most important thing we can do in the legislature, to be honest. And I've made it really core to who I am and what I do in Annapolis. And I welcome all comers. And so I appreciate, it's easy to say, you know, I was here first. I knew Dave Matthews Band back when they were playing Charlottesville in 19, you know, and I work hard not to do that.
Are you mocking me, Senator? That sounds directly like something I would do.
and so I've been doing this this work, this criminal justice reform work, before it was as prominent as it is now. But I'm so happy that it's become so because a lot of allies have joined our cause and are big believers, as I am, that everyone deserves a second chance and that people who have made mistakes in their lives, folks who have served time in our criminal justice system, deserve to live lives of dignity with full employment and access to all the things that you and I enjoy. And so making sure that our criminal justice system is fair and making sure that for those who went through it, that they have opportunities when they leave the system is really, really important to me. And of course, along those lines, we have decriminalized certain things, including small amounts of marijuana. And at some point soon, and we can talk about this a little more, I think we're going to fully legalize small amounts of recreational marijuana, and that's the right way to go.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about that.
So as you might know, Damian, the Speaker of the House has formed a work group on the House side, and the Senate President has formed an informal work group on our side to see whether we need to take the next step when it comes to cannabis in Maryland. So medical marijuana is already legal. It's been a very successful program thus far. It is thriving. And most importantly, patients who have conditions that can be helped by cannabis have access to this medicine. Now the next question is, do we want to legalize cannabis for recreational use, for adult recreational use? I think the answer is yes. I think the speaker would like to put this issue on the ballot and have the people of Maryland have their say. That's something I know I welcome. And hopefully we can pass a companion bill that goes with that referendum. So should the people of Maryland decide that this is the direction they want to go, we'll have the law implement automatically when that referendum passes.
Let the people decide.
That's right. We did that with gaming in Maryland, and it's been very successful in Baltimore City and Prince George's County throughout our state. And I think it invested Marylanders in the industry in a way that was really positive. So yes, let's put it on the ballot, but yes, let's also make sure we have an implementation bill so that when it passes, it goes into effect, but we don't have to wait, you know, an additional 2-3 years before the industry is up and running.
Let's talk about all of these major conversations around policing. It sounds like Maryland had a pretty historic session, not only against the backdrop of its own history, but also compared to jurisdictions across states across the country. You were at the center of that. I think you are near universally viewed as a very thoughtful, progressive collaborator that tries to bring people together towards solutions. Just when we thought we didn't have any room for that, right? So talk to me about the challenge of that role. I wanted to talk about the other stuff before this, because I think doing all that work gave you so much credibility to have the breadth to bring all those voices together. Again, something that no campaign material can really describe adequately, but something you as a legislator invest an unusual amount of time in. I'd love to hear about your process and the outcomes.
Yeah, it's a really good question. So my role in this process was as a collaborator, as a convener, as a problem solver. At the beginning of this process, I knew very quickly that this was a process that needed to be Black-led, that this needed to be led by voices of color. And that meant my chairman, Will Smith, the first African-American chair of the Judicial Proceedings Committee, was going to play a prominent and important role in this process. It also meant our new Speaker of the House, Adrienne Jones, the first woman and first African-American speaker in Maryland history. And then the vice chair of the Judiciary Committee, Vanessa Atterbury, I knew was going to be an important and prominent voice in this process. And so my goal was to assist them in moving this forward in a way that ensured real accountability, real reform, and goes in a direction that is pragmatic and can be implemented in police departments across Maryland. So if you have a second, I'll just tell you what we did. We repealed the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. We enhanced police accountability by establishing civilian oversight. We required all law enforcement agencies to utilize body cameras. We demilitarized the police. We restricted the use of no-knock warrants, and we returned local control of the Baltimore City Police Department to Baltimore City. And then one last thing, we passed sweeping use of force legislation that criminalizes any officer who uses excessive force. So it was an entire package. We worked diligently on it. It took a while to get where we needed to get to, but I'm so proud of what we were able to accomplish under Will Smith's leadership. And let me mention one more name who was deeply involved in that, and that is Jill Carter, the senator from Baltimore City, who has led on so many of these issues for so many years, and she was deeply involved in everything we did as well.
What do you see coming up with the maps? I'd love to hear an insider's guide to the map conversation, because it seems like no matter how good the Washington Post or the Baltimore Sun or Maryland Matters can be, there's always a backstory and backstories behind the backstory. So I was just wondering if you could give me one of those legislative perspectives that would draw back the curtain a little bit. Yeah. It seems to be real quickly, just set it up one more. It just seems to be one of these issues that in many other parts of the country, people go to great extremes for partisan purposes. And our maps in various iterations have been held up to the highest levels of scrutiny. Just talk to me about the whole experience. And if you can just give us that insider's view somehow, from your view, we'd love to hear that.
Well, I wish I could. I'll tell you what, on a lot of these issues, I can give you kind of behind the scenes stuff that happened in the back room. But on the maps, the process has been incredibly public and very transparent. And that's as Bill Ferguson and Adrienne Jones wanted it to be. And so there's not a lot of happening in the background. They have held hearings throughout the state to get input from citizens about what they want in the maps. And they've been listening and drawing the maps based on those recommendations. So I wish I had some super secret intel here for you, Damian.
I think it must be a generational shift. from the cloakrooms to the data mappings online, right? So it's less intrigue is better government, I suspect.
I think that's right, and especially as regards to the map. There's a necessity in Annapolis from time to time to get together in small groups and work things out, and I'm happy to do that. But when you're doing something as big as putting an electoral map together, both for the congressional districts and for the legislative districts. You have to do it all out in the open so that people know what you're doing and can trust in the result. Because what we produce will only have the support of Marylanders if they felt like they had the input that they needed in that process. And so far, that's been the case.
Wow, that's great tone. That's great tone. Talk to me about your legal background. You're one of a member of the General Assembly that has, you know, one of the most, both a public school background, but also at some of the most elite academies in all of law there at Berkeley. I'd love to hear about your educational experience in Montgomery County and how it informed your growth as a person.
Well, I was one of those guys that loved law school, and there are not many of us, but what law school really does is make sure that you see all sides of an issue. And for me as a legislator, that's been invaluable. To understand the people that I disagree with helps me understand how to process issues and move bills forward. And so to the extent, like we were talking about earlier, that much of my role on my committee is as a problem solver, a lot of that comes out of how I was taught in law school and the way to get from here to there through empathy, through listening, through understanding, and through convening people and bringing them together. So I think it's a great skill set to be an attorney in Annapolis. I know there's a stereotype that goes back many, many decades that legislators are, you know, are all attorneys. In fact, we're a dying breed in Annapolis. I wish there were more attorneys in Annapolis. And so I try to use my legal skills for good, both the problem solving side and kind of the substantive experience I've had as an.
What's your favorite sort of idiosyncratic part about serving in the Senate of Maryland? Is there any sort of thing that we might not expect that you're a fan of, or something peculiar that that you kind of dig on about serving in one of the nation's longest running deliberative bodies, right?
I'm very fortunate to serve in the Senate. I guess this is really in the weeds, Damian, but maybe your audience can appreciate it. So on the House side, there's something called second reader rule. And it's really obscure. It's not written anywhere. But when a bill comes up for second reader, which is really the first time it's heard on the floor, there's this rule that basically says that's not really the time for debate. You can't really stand up and ask questions about a bill then. Wait until it's on third reader, which is the final vote, before you really bring your debating skills to the floor. And the Senate side doesn't have the second reader rule. And debate is encouraged much earlier in the process. And I think that's wonderful. So the floor of the Senate really is not a stage where kind of, you know, statements and talking points are made. It's much more of a real, genuine debate on the merits with questions going back and forth, questions that people don't have the answers to. In other words, not pre-planned. And so I love that the Senate doesn't have this second reader rule. I always respected it on the House side. It was cultural, but the Senate has this really open debate. And for someone like me who enjoys talking about the merits of bills and vetting legislation as it goes through that process, I think it's an important cultural touchstone in the Senate that we have and that we need to keep.
You've got a lot of understanding of the federal dynamic, the state's relationship with our federal delegation and everything that's going on in Washington. Is there anything from your pretty special view there at the district line that you think Marylanders in Baltimore or on the western or eastern parts of the state should be thinking about that maybe we haven't started understanding yet?
Well, here's what sometimes I feel like we don't understand. I feel like sometimes we don't understand how incredible our federal officials are, because they've been with us for so long. Like Ben Cardin is an amazing senator, and he's our senator, and you see him everywhere. And so it's easy to say, oh, Ben Cardin, he's, you know, I know him, but he's really something special that our state has. Same with Chris Van Hollen, who represented my area in the state Senate, and now, of course, is the U.S. Senator. Between the two of them, we are just incredibly lucky to have federal officials who care deeply about their state and the people they represent. And same is true in my area for Jamie Raskin, who's now on television everywhere. People see him at the grocery store, and he's just like a neighbor. And so it's easy to forget he is a national leader and constitutional scholar. And some areas have legislators.
And a super mensch. He's a super mensch.
That's exactly right. Wish I could make him a uniform, like a superhero uniform, Superman. Right. And so it's easy to take these guys for granted, but we are so lucky to have them. And I see it up close when I meet with them. They are fighting each and every day on behalf of Marylanders. And I wouldn't want any of your listeners to forget that.
Let's talk about Jake Weissman. It sounds like he is going to continue in your service in some capacities, going from being the top staff person in the Senate of Maryland as the chief of staff to two Senate presidents, and now a top administrative role with the Montgomery County government, which is the biggest county in the state, the biggest deal, a lot of scrutiny. And I'd love to hear about your view of Jake's pretty neat looking transition there.
Yeah, well, Jake Weissman is just an incredible human being. And there are very few people who are really good at politics and really good at policy making. And Jake is the total package. And so Montgomery County is now lucky to have him in their local government. And, you know, perhaps I don't want to speak for Jake, but perhaps that's why he took the job, because everyone knew him as this brilliant political operator. And many of us also knew that as a policymaker, he was fantastic, but perhaps it was overshadowed by his sheer political skill. And now in Montgomery County government, where he has no political role and only a policymaking role, people will see what I always knew, which is Jake is a wonderful policymaker who will make a huge difference here in Montgomery County. Let me just give you an example. I represent the White Flint area. That mall was taken down and kind of, there's basically been this pile of rubble for about a decade. And one of the aspects of Jake's portfolio is economic development. And so I know Jake is working diligently to get the redevelopment of White Flint back on track. And as the senator for that area, that's so important to me. So we're really lucky to have Jake in Montgomery County.
Well, you all should come up and check out what's going on in downtown Columbia, Maryland, because I think White Flint and Columbia both had entitlement conversations about the same time, and there's a lot going on up there. Your Senate colleague, the chairman of the Budget and Tax Committee, Chairman Gazzotti, he is of those parts. So you guys should check, you all should come up and check out the progress there and see if there's any lessons learned. That's a cool, I'm a land use nerd. So
yeah.
The White Flint conversation that Jake gets to lead is a really important one, not just for Montgomery County, but for the whole region.
No question about it. And let me just give a quick shout out. You know, when Jake left, it created this very big vacuum. But Sally Robb, the new chief of staff to the president, has filled it ably. And Sally and Jake are very different people. But where they're not different is that they're both brilliant and both really good at what they do. And it's been a real pleasure to get to know Sally even better than I knew her before. I served with her when she was on the House side and I was on the House side. And Sally is doing an incredible job on behalf of the Senate president and also just interacting with members like me. And we're very lucky to have her as the Senate president's chief of staff.
She's a superstar. And because the Senate of Maryland is such a progressive place, we don't have to put the first on her, the first this with
right.
The wonderful Vicky Gruber showing us all how it's done.
That's true.
You all have amazing staff in the Senate of Maryland. Senator Wahlstreicher, thank you so much for joining us on Senator Maryland. Any last words you want to leave with our audience here that I'm sure loves to hear your voice?
Well, Damian, thank you for having me. We're going into a really intense period with the special session coming up in December and the regular session coming up in January. And the folks who listen to this podcast are very much involved in everything we do in Annapolis. And I just want to thank them for their advocacy. We can't do this without people on the outside telling us about issues that they're seeing in their industries, in their communities, and coming to us for solutions, which of course we're always happy to help with. So thank you to you and thank you to your listeners, Damian.
Yeah, you just bring up a great point I'd like to riff on for a second, if I could steal your thoughts for another minute or two. You know, these advocates in Annapolis, whether you're working for a teachers union whose constituency is facing unprecedented upheaval owing to the pandemic, or you're representing the hospitals, or you're representing the nursing facilities, the Health Facilities Association, you know, I feel like all those people have, the Dental Association, all those people have had this impossible role where they have had to help the ultimate helpers. And every time they go to help there in Annapolis, whether it's delivering a complicated message to you all or negotiating something to keep off all your plates so you can focus on more important crisis issues, you know, you just get a sense that these people have given so much because they're trying to keep up with this constituency they serve, and it's impossible. And yet they are incredibly resilient. And I hope, owing to what you just said there, they get a sense of the appreciation people have for them going above and beyond, for their communities that are going above and beyond. And they should have no shame in not being able to keep up with these hospital leaders and these frontline workers at our grocery stores or our teachers. You know, none of us can keep up with what those people have been doing, but that doesn't take away from the really remarkable the work they've done. I just want to thank you for being a bit of a light on that.
Well, my pleasure. I think you're exactly right. There are an incredible number of doctors and nurses and firefighters and grocery store workers who have really just been heroes these past almost 2 years. And as we come out of COVID, it's easy to forget about that. It's easy to take it for granted. But so many of these folks are just exhausted. They've been working so hard under difficult circumstances for so many months. And the least that we can do as legislators in the Senate of Maryland and in the entire General Assembly is reciprocate by showing our hard work and appreciation on their behalf. So thank you for raising that, Damian.
Senator Walsh, thank you so much for everything you do for the state of Maryland and the people of Kensington, Wheaton, Chevy Chase. You got it all down.
Thanks
so much,
Damian.
For doing it. Thanks for joining us.